Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I think you can hear me. I can hear me, even. We've got a very nice amplification right now. Well, it's very good of you to all come out to late in the day, just before vacation. So it's just not the same giving a lecture if no one listens. When I finished my lecture earlier today, I was talking about the crisis of the secession of the southern states that came to a climax in the last part of 1860 and the beginning of 1861. In the beginning, seven of the southern states declared their withdrawal from the United States of America. And when it became clear that President Lincoln was not going to accept their secession, and when he made a call for 75,000 militiamen from the state militias to be sent to Washington, D.C. for the purpose of suppressing what he called and always considered a rebellion, not a secession. When he called for those armed forces, four other southern states seceded, having decided that the use of armed force was unacceptable, and that if the northern government were going to use such methods, then the southerners would meet force with force. And so the war actually began in the spring of 1861. Now, this war, like probably every other war in history, involved a lot of miscalculation on both sides. Almost by definition, wars involve miscalculations because at least one side might have been better off by never going to war. Perhaps there are exceptions, but in general, when nation states go to war, each expecting to be victorious, then one of them is certain to be wrong. And very often, even the victor turns out to suffer so much loss that the victory is hollow. It's worth very little. In this case, both sides expected the fighting to be very brief, but for different reasons. The Southerners and the Northerners had been quarreling politically for decades, and they had developed considerable hostilities, especially in the case of some individuals, toward those on the other side. And they developed a kind of contempt for one another. The Northerners had come to think of the Southerners as just people who were always blustering and acting tough. But they thought when push comes to shove, when we really exert force on these people, they will capitulate. They will give in very quickly. The Southerners, on the other hand, always fancied themselves macho, tough guys, and they thought that the Northerners were just less than men, who wouldn't really fight if the fighting got tough. And so both sides had the same kind of misconception about how hard the other was willing to fight. And unfortunately, because they were so wrong on both sides, this war went on for 4 years, involved a tremendous amount of bloodshed and destruction. Especially in the South, where most of the fighting took place. Ultimately, more than 620,000 soldiers were killed, and some 400,000 others were seriously wounded, and many people suffered in other ways. Many civilians were harmed in the south because eventually the northern armies conducted a very brutal form of warfare in which they sometimes carried out military operations against civilians as well as against military forces. So this became a kind of practice, rehearsal for the total wars of the 20th century. The professional armies of Europe, especially the Prussians, mocked the Americans. They made fun of the Americans. They said, these aren't armies, these are mobs. But in many respects, the Americans in the Civil War pioneered methods of warfare that would be used very extensively by both sides in World War I, especially the use of railroads to bring equipment, arms, and supplies, the use of fortifications, trenches, the use of heavy artillery. Submarines were devised for the first time in warfare by both sides during the Civil War, and other innovations were created. The first machine gun was put to use. But for the most part, the battles in the Civil War were simply contests of infantrymen with rifles confronting one another in a not always very organized way. And just continuing to fight, sometimes for days and days, and until thousands of people had been killed. In the larger battles, the casualties ran as high as 40 or 50,000 men killed in 2 or 3 days. So these battles were horrible. The institutions that had existed at the beginning of the war were altered quite fundamentally as a result of the war. Now, President Lincoln did not go to war to abolish slavery or to destroy the institution of slavery. Indeed, even after he took office as president, he was willing to make a deal whereby he would guarantee that the Southerners could continue to have slavery in the states where it existed, and he would even support the enactment of a constitutional change that would guarantee that no interference would ever take place with slavery in the states where it already existed. So even though Lincoln is known as the Great Emancipator, because he issued something called the Emancipation Proclamation that took effect at the beginning of 1863 in the midst of the war, emancipating the slaves was a byproduct of war. It was actually a war measure that the Union, the Northern side, adopted to make use of black men as troops and also to give their cause better standing with Europeans. Some European nations were tempted to ally themselves or to provide assistance to the Confederate States, and in an attempt to represent its side of the war in a more appealing way, the Union decided that it would issue the Emancipation Proclamation. But what that proclamation did was free only the slaves in the areas controlled by the Southerners. It was carefully written up so that exactly where it applied corresponded to the areas Southerners controlled. In other words, the Emancipation Proclamation did not free one single slave. You can think of it as a piece of public relations. Now, during the war, because of all the confusion and disorganization, some slaves began to run away and to create their own freedom. Sometimes when the Northern armies were in the area, they would run away from their plantations and go to wherever the Northern armies were. But the Northern armies regarded these slaves as a nuisance. They didn't want these people. They had to be fed and somehow taken care of, and that was just one more job they didn't want to do while they were trying to fight a war. So the treatment of slaves was really not especially good, even by the people that pretended to be their liberators. And legally, the slaves were freed only after the war ended and the Constitution was changed by an amendment, Amendment Number 13, abolishing slavery everywhere in the United States. But during the war itself, slavery had continued to be practiced in many areas of states loyal to the Union, states such as Maryland and Missouri, and even in the District of Columbia, where the national capital is located, people continued to own and use slaves throughout the war. So, in retrospect, many historians argue that the Civil War, as terrible as the casualties were and the destruction and all the other harm that came out of it, it was a good thing because it was necessary to fight the war in order to abolish slavery. But one can certainly argue it was not necessary. Slavery was abolished everywhere in the Western Hemisphere without violence, except in two places: Haiti, where the slaves themselves rebelled against their masters, and the United States, where this terrible war was fought, whose byproduct or unintended effect was the elimination of slavery. Now, that did have a great effect. Whatever brought it about, the fact that slavery had been destroyed completely upset the economy of the South. So at the end of the war, the South was not only in terrible shape because it had suffered a lot of physical destruction of houses and businesses and railroads and other capital, and had many people killed, about 260,000 Southern men were killed in the war, and the population of Southern men of military age was at that time probably about, let's see, 1.5 million. So about one out of every six Southern men of military age was killed, and many others were maimed or seriously hurt in the fighting. So the South was in terrible shape, and then besides that, they had to somehow reorganize their economy. Everywhere it had relied upon slave labor, and that was a big part of the Southern economy. So they had to quickly devise new arrangements, and they experimented with a great variety of arrangements for hiring the freed slaves as wage workers, or renting land to them for different kinds of of rental payments. Sometimes rental payments in money, but more often payments made as a share of the crop they raised. That confusion and necessity for reinventing Southern agricultural institutions made recovery from the war even more difficult and time-consuming. So the Southern agricultural economy took 10 or 15 years just to get back to where it was before the war. And that meant that during that period, the people were relatively impoverished as a result of not producing as much as they had before. So in the South, the worst effects of the war took place, but the North was greatly affected as well. And during the war, the Northern government had created a number of new institutions. They created a system of national banks to issue a uniform national currency. And those banks began to operate during the war, and then the law was shaped in such a way that it made it very hard for any other kind of bank to compete. And so the other banks were placed at a great disadvantage for quite a while until they themselves invented ways to become competitive again. During the war, the Republicans who controlled the government did what Republicans wanted to do, which was make the tariffs much higher so that they would protect American industrial producers from foreign competition, especially British competition. So the average tariff was raised to about 50%, so that if you imported something worth a dollar, you had to pay an additional half a dollar for the privilege of bringing it into the United States. And of course, that made the cost of imported goods much higher, and therefore made domestically produced goods more competitive. Sometimes made it possible to produce them, whereas otherwise they would have not been producible at a profit. During the war, the Republicans adopted subsidies of various kinds to their political friends. Several railroads were designed to go from the middle of the country, where the population had reached, out to the Pacific coast. In that great western area at the time, hardly anyone lived other than some Indians. And so these railroads were not viable commercial enterprises. If left to the market, no one would have decided to invest in building a railroad from St. Louis to San Francisco. That would have been an obviously idiotic investment. But the federal government subsidized several of these companies, and then after the war continued to subsidize other railroad companies operating railroads in the western part of the United States. And eventually, in the form of subsidies, they gave a large amount of land. And when the railroads received that land, of course, they immediately sold it when they could. It was not easy to sell it because there was no immediate market for most of it. So they tried to create a market, and they did all kinds of things, including sending agents to Europe to try to entice Europeans to move to the areas where they had land for sale. And it's amusing to look at the advertisements they used to spread around Europe to make some of these western areas of the United States look like the Garden of Eden. They look like paradise, when in reality they were almost like deserts. But Europeans were not without the ability to get information from other sources. And some of them did take these offers to come and settle on the railroad lands, and eventually some of those lands were made very valuable and productive. But it took a long time. And indeed, some of the railroad subsidy lands were never sold and are still owned today by the railroad companies or the companies that were formed from those old railroad companies later. So we had these new institutions of Republican rule, currency regulation, national banks, high tariffs, subsidies to favored enterprises. These kinds of interventions in the market that the Jeffersonians hated and that most of the Southerners hated, and yet they became the standing policies from that time until well into the 20th century. during most of that period, Republican presidents were elected to office. There was only one Democratic president elected all the way from Lincoln to 1912 when Woodrow Wilson was elected as a Democrat. But during that long period of 50 years, it was all Republican presidents except for one, a Democrat named Grover Cleveland, who had two terms in office, not consecutive, separate. During the late 19th century, as the southern economy began to recover and the northern economy grew very quickly, the whole national economy experienced a long period of extremely rapid economic growth. The gross domestic product during that long period from the Civil War to the First World War, on average, grew at about 4% per year. And of course, anything that grows at 4% per year needs only 18 years to become twice as big. So the size of the American economy was becoming enormous during this period. American industry developed very rapidly. All kinds of American commerce was developed. Americans became quite inventive and devised many new forms of tools and machinery and equipment. And people responded to opportunities in this huge free market to make investments, to gain wealth, to better their positions. Even ordinary workers tended to become very much better off over a period of a few years. So this was a very progressive period, all things considered, but certainly not a period of smooth development. It had many disruptions. It had business depressions, financial panics. It had all sorts of uncertainties, along with the general tendency toward economic progress. And as a result of that, there were always various people in the society who were unhappy, who felt somehow that they weren't getting their fair share of all the new wealth that was being created, or they were being cheated somehow by bankers or railroads or by someone else they dealt with. And so politics in this period was certainly not calm, but there was no civil war. There was nothing violent except for some of the labor relations, when people trying to form labor unions would sometimes enter into violent encounters with employers and their representatives. Now, when we get toward the end of the 19th century, we begin to have a shift in the political and ideological situation in the United States, and the period from about 1900 to the First World War has been called by historians the Progressive Era, to distinguish it from the years before and afterwards. There were things about the Progressive Era that did set them apart, and for our purposes in this course, where we want to pay special attention to how economic policies were adopted and why, how they were changed, the most important thing about the Progressive Era is that it included a serious ideological change, especially among the opinion leaders of the United States. Not among everybody. The middle classes, many members of the middle class, small business people, farmers with substantial farms, such people as that for the most part, continued to believe the same things they had believed in the late 19th century. And that was, not exactly, but approximately, the kind of belief system or ideology known as classical liberalism. Classical liberalism is the general belief that free markets are superior to government direction, that government ought not to do very much, that government should be what is sometimes called a night watchman. It should guard people's property rights. It should keep order. It should perhaps provide a few services or goods such as education or roads, but not very much, because the classical liberals continued to share the Jeffersonian view that government is a dangerous thing, that it's always risky to give it too much power. It also tends to be corrupted, especially corrupted by people who have money and can bribe or otherwise reward government officials to do what they want, even though it is in conflict with the general interest of most people. So the classical liberals continued to believe that government is a dangerous thing at best, and a menace sometimes. They weren't anarchists. The classical liberals believed in a limited government, but they wanted to make those limits quite tight. They didn't want to let government grow very big. But the ideological change that took place in the progressive era, especially among opinion leaders, among people attending the best universities such as Harvard and Yale, people writing for newspapers, among some of the judges, well-educated people who involved themselves in the world of ideas and paid attention to political affairs, they began to change their views. Some of the bigger businessmen began to change their views in similar ways, though perhaps not for the same reasons. Some of the middle-class people in the cities, especially the big cities, began to change their views in the same direction. So the tendency here toward progressive views and away from classical liberal views was a tendency to not only tolerate bigger government, more active government, but actually to demand it, to say that there are a lot of problems in society or problems with the operation of the economy, and the government can fix these things. It can make life better. The progressives even thought that they were not placing burdens on people when government would get bigger. They thought they were providing a kind of liberation, because they thought, for example, if big business is treating customers badly, if it's producing poor quality goods or charging monopoly prices for what it sells, then everybody's better off if we give government power to somehow control the operation of big business. So they weren't under the impression that they were creating Stalinism. They actually deluded themselves into thinking that they could control the government and make it a force for good. They also believed very much in what was sometimes called technocracy, the idea that experts should be put in charge of managing society. When they looked around at cities, for example, and they had their elected mayor and their elected city council, and those people were usually corrupt politicians, and they might take an interest in helping immigrants and helping poor people in exchange for their votes. Well, the urban middle-class people were afraid of these immigrants. They thought These people are a danger to American society. They thought they're a threat. The last thing we want is for them to have political influence. So the whole idea of having the city run by politicians who are somewhat responsive to these dangerous groups is a bad idea. And what we need is some expert to be put in charge of running the city, taking care of the streets and the lighting and all the other things the city was providing as public goods to the residents. So city managers, that was something invented by the progressives. They had the idea that somehow these experts would be non-political. This was an enormous mistake. Because, in fact, anyone who is in a position to control government power is by definition political. He can't possibly be neutral. There's no way he can satisfy everybody at the same time when he can do only one thing. You see, the beauty of a market system is that people can satisfy their own desires without demanding that other people satisfy their desires in the same way. If I like pork, I can go into the market and buy pork to eat. And if you like beef, you can go to the market and buy beef. But if everybody had to eat the same thing, as everybody often has to live with the same government policy, then always somebody is going to be disappointed or angry. So the idea of a non-political government official was self-contradictory. But it took a long time for the progressives to discover the problems with their technocracy. And in fact, in some cases, they never did discover the problems, and their descendants in American politics today still often try to argue that experts should be put in charge of things. Whether we look at domestic policy or at foreign policy, the progressive era is a watershed. It's a big change. In domestic policy, the 19th century had been, not entirely, but for the most part, a century of limited government, of people who didn't want government to do a great deal and who were suspicious of government. That changed with the progressives. Afterwards, the American people would tend to favor active government for a variety of purposes. In foreign policy, there was another equally great change. In the 19th century, Americans had usually, not always, but usually followed the advice of Jefferson and Washington to keep out of other people's fights. Later on, this position came to be called isolationism. And nowadays, when Americans talk about foreign policy and someone is called an isolationist, it's always a smear. It's an insult, a form of ridicule brought against them, because many people think it was isolationists that kept the United States from entering World War II until quite late in the war, and they regret that. They think the United States should have entered the war quicker, or maybe even before the war started, the United States should have used its influence and its power to intimidate the aggressors and keep them from launching attacks on the democracies. But in truth, the Americans were never isolationists. Hardly anybody wanted to have no dealings with foreigners and just seal America off from the world. The better name for this foreign policy was non-interventionism. The idea was not that we won't deal with the other people of the world. We certainly would deal with them through trade, through cultural relationships, through personal relationships, in every possible way, we simply wouldn't be sending our armies out somewhere to get involved in their wars. You know, they would be responsible for cutting each other's throats without our help. But that non-interventionist policy that tended to rule in the 19th century was also challenged during the Progressive Era and ultimately abandoned. And ever since 1898, when America launched an unprovoked war against Spain, Americans have been looking for opportunities to butt into everybody's business in the world, often with armed force. And so they became a kind of what we call a bull in a china shop, you know, rampaging around the world, causing trouble, adding to the trouble that's already there. So this progressive era shift in foreign policy was extremely important, not just for the Americans, but for everybody on earth. And it's still having an effect today. We find it exemplified in the American attack on Iraq, for example. Unprovoked war, just undertaken because some Americans in power think they know what is better for other parts of the world, and they also labor under the mistaken belief that they can make the world the way they want it, that they can mold it as if it were clay, and as if other people wouldn't resist at all, and they could move them about like pieces on a chessboard. But they cannot do that at all easily, and usually not at all. The Progressive Era involved a variety of institutional changes at all levels of government. I mentioned the city managers. There were many changes made at the state level of government. States became more actively involved in intervening in the economy, but the national government especially became much more interventionist during the Progressive Era. And in 1913, near the end of that era, the two most important institutional changes, perhaps of the entire century, took place. One was the change of the Constitution by the adoption of the Amendment Number 16, which made the collection of income tax constitutional by the national government. Before that time, an income tax had been used during the war between the states, but the court later decided that it was unconstitutional, and then Congress had passed another income tax in 1894, but the Supreme Court once again declared that law unconstitutional, and so it never took effect. But some people wanted an income tax because they thought this would be a tax that affected only the very rich. And they said, we have these high tariffs, and they cause prices to be increased for everybody, including poor people. So poor people pay the tariff, but rich people, because they don't even spend a lot of their money for consumption goods, they don't have to, even in proportion to their income, bear the burden of the tariff. So it's unfair to have poor people disproportionately paying the customs duties, and the income tax was supposed to offset that unfair burden. The income tax was designed so that you had to have a very high income before you owed any tax at all. After the first income tax law was put into effect in 1913, more than 98% of all people owed no national income tax. So yes, that looked as if, for sure, this was a tax that affected only those people with the very high incomes. But very quickly, as soon as the United States entered World War I, the tax rates were increased hugely. In 1913, the highest tax rate you could ever have from the federal tax was 7%. 7%. In 1918, the tax had been pushed up so that the highest rate was 77%. It had been made 11 times greater, almost overnight, as a way to help the government get revenue to fight World War I. And after the war, even though the tax rates were reduced several times during the 1920s, they were never put back where they had been before. This was what I call a ratchet phenomenon, a ratchet effect. When government seizes new powers in a national emergency, the tendency has been for those new powers to be only partly surrendered after the emergency is over. So each emergency becomes the occasion for the government to permanently increase its power and its control of economic life. The other great change that took place in 1913 was the creation of a central bank. We call it the Federal Reserve System, and I probably need not tell you that. The Federal Reserve is known to everybody in the world now because the dollar is the most important currency in the world, and that's the currency the Federal Reserve issues. Federal Reserve notes and deposits. The Federal Reserve was not a central bank in exactly the way that some of the European central banks were designed. It was not one institution, one bank organization. It had 12 parts, regional banks. And in the beginning, not very strong direction above the 12 branch banks. So they made their own decisions about the interest rates to charge when banks borrowed from them. The Federal Reserve can be described as a banker's bank. It's where banks keep their reserve deposits of cash, and they keep them in the form of checking accounts with the Federal Reserve Bank. And when they need actual currency, they can call upon their accounts to get the Federal Reserve to issue paper money, dollars that Americans stuff their pockets with. So this Federal Reserve System was created, and it had the power, effectively, to create money out of nothing. It was supposed to keep its own obligations, its own liabilities, in line with holdings of gold, and it was there was a formula established that required the Federal Reserve itself to hold gold reserves against the notes and deposits it issued, but eventually that requirement itself was abandoned, and at that point the Federal Reserve, we always call it the Fed. The Fed was in a position to create money from thin air. It didn't have to do anything. It just wrote in its books an amount credited to some bank as a deposit. That bank then used the Federal Reserve deposit account as reserves for its own making of loans and investments, and created money in the form of checking account balances. In that way. And if the commercial bank wanted to give people paper money, then it got Federal Reserve notes from the Federal Reserve Bank and used those. No longer did individual banks issue their own forms of paper money as they had for a long time in the 19th century. So this central bank with the power to create money out of thin air was in a position to inflate the money stock whenever it decided to do so. And the result was that during the time the Federal Reserve has operated, the value of the American dollar has fallen to about 5% of what it was before the Federal Reserve. They've increased the money stock so fast that the value of the money, its purchasing power, has fallen to 1/20th of what it was when they started. This seems like a poor record at stabilizing the currency, to my way of thinking. If you look at the 19th century, when the United States had no real central bank, it had some inflation during wars because governments found ways to issue money, but that was always offset after the wars by deflation. So that the long-term trend of the 19th century was approximately no inflation whatsoever. The purchasing power of a dollar in 1900 was roughly what it had been in 1800. The creation of central banks with the power to create money was the ability to destroy the currency. And that's what has been done. Now, because nearly every country in the world has been even bigger sinner than the United States at inflating the currency, the U.S. dollar looks like a strong currency. You know, if you have a choice between cruzeiros from Brazil and U.S. dollars, you're probably better off holding dollars. But that's only because in Brazil, they may issue double the money stock in 1 year. I mean, sometimes in Latin America, the central banks go crazy. And so they have hyperinflation every once in a while. And, of course, hyperinflation has taken place in Europe as well, usually in association with war or immediately after war, like the German hyperinflation of the early 1920s. But none of these things can be possible if the money system is a metallic standard. If people use gold or silver or some other commodity as their medium of exchange, it's impossible to suddenly increase the amount of that medium of exchange by a large amount, because a commodity has to be produced. It's costly to produce. You have to use labor and capital and other inputs to produce a commodity. To produce deposits on the Federal Reserve's books, you don't have to do anything. Just write them down. Voila! There you have all the money you want. And likewise for other central banks. So even though this seemed in the beginning like an institution that could serve useful purposes that might even be used to prevent business depressions, in practice, it did just the opposite. In practice, it made business depressions worse, or even caused business depressions. Certainly, the Federal Reserve had a very large role in making the Great Depression of the 1930s so severe in the United States, because at that time it stood by and whistled tunes while the money supply contracted and did nothing to use its powers to offset that contraction. And the result was bank failures by the thousands and bankruptcies and the wreck of the entire financial system. But that meant you could not count on this institution. And you still can't count on it. Today, the central bankers have been doing better for 20 years or so, and so everybody acts as if there's no problem. With central banking, we're safe. You know, we can count on the European Central Bank to act sensibly, to not inflate the amount of money in existence too much, to cause prices to rise too much. We can count on the Federal Reserve System. But we can't count on these institutions. There's nothing to make them avoid the same mistakes they made in the past. Now, why did they make these mistakes in the past? And the answer is they were created by governments and directly or indirectly placed under pressure to do what governments wanted them to do. And there's nothing a government likes more than having access to a ready source of money. If it can create it out of thin air, so much the better. See, in medieval days, the king would clip the coins. He would take the gold or silver coins and shave a little bit off the sides and accumulate new silver and gold to make new coins with. And that made the existing ones, when he put them back into circulation, a little less valuable because they had less metal in them. It was a way of taxing people by shaving or debasing the currency. Well, modern governments have ways of debasing the currency you can't even see. You have to follow the accounts of the Federal Reserve System to watch the debasement of the currency. But this was, along with the income tax, an institution that allowed the government of the United States to grow enormously in the 20th century, to undertake all kinds of new policies and tasks that it never could have afforded otherwise. Indeed, the wars it fought never could have been fought except that it had the Federal Reserve System and the income tax to help it accumulate revenue. So these are extremely important changes. The government began to impose new kinds of regulations of all kinds, and some of them increased the federal regulation of the railroad system. Some of them involved putting regulations on the producers of foods or drugs. Others involved requirements for the inspection of products such as meats. There were a variety of new regulations imposed during the Progressive Era. And when we look at where these came from, there is usually a story. Historians used to always tell the story that the regulations were put there to protect the public. That perhaps the public was getting bad quality meat. So people demanded that the government protect them from bad quality meat, and the government passed the Meat Inspection Act of 1906. That used to be a standard story in the history books. But when we actually do good research on how the Meat Inspection Act came about, we find something very different happening. We find that the real pressure put on politicians was brought not by consumers who had worries about bad meat. It was really brought by meat producers. And by having an inspection law, some of the big producers that already produced good, high-quality meat, they didn't have to have a law telling them to do so. It was just good business. You know, poisoning your customers is never a good deal. Even though consumer advocates often talk as if it is. But the big meat producers in America already had good safety standards. They didn't need a law to force it on them. But they were competing with a lot of smaller meat producers, and they knew that if they could get an inspection act that these small companies had to follow, so they had to fill out the same forms and hire the same inspectors, that the burden those small competitors bore would be greater per unit they produced. And therefore, they would be less competitive. It would be like putting a tax on them, which would actually benefit the big producers. And in one regulation after another, we find the same kind of action going on. That producers with political influence use regulations to create competitive advantages for themselves, or sometimes to create markets for what they sell. This kind of political action goes on very actively today in all countries. And when you see a new regulation, and it always has a story about how it's good for the general public, you would be wise to always ask, well, who really put the pressure on? Who was behind this? Who influenced whom in the legislature? How did this law really get made? And more often than not, you will find some influential producer groups using regulation to promote their ends, not to promote the public interest. Some of the progressives were not even like scheming businessmen. They were like sanctimonious do-gooders. They were people that wanted to make everybody follow their own rules of personal conduct. For a long time, many Americans had opposed consumption of alcoholic beverages. And they wanted to outlaw them. It wasn't enough for them to say, "I don't drink." They wanted to forbid everybody from drinking. And they had worked at the state level to get laws passed against the sale or production of alcoholic beverages. And in some states, they had been successful. But their great ambition was to get a national law that would forbid the production and sale of alcoholic beverages. They thought that was an evil thing. It was a righteous action to take whiskey away from people, to take beer away from them. Now you can imagine what some of the immigrants thought about that. Some of the people from Bohemia or Germany, the idea of taking their beer away was like, you know, the threat to murder them. But these immigrant groups did not have as much political standing, as much influence in the power with the powers of government as these prohibitionists had. And ultimately, the prohibitionists succeeded in getting the Constitution of the United States changed to forbid alcoholic beverages. They did it first during World War I, misrepresenting it as a conservation measure. They said during the war, it's essential that we use all of our grain for war purposes, you know, for feeding the starving Belgians, or for sending food to the troops. We can't be wasting grain by making it into alcoholic beverages. So during the war, the government imposed a form of prohibition, still allowed beer, or a weak beer, but it forbade all of the hard liquors. And then when the Constitution was changed in 1919, we had national prohibition. And it was against the law to make or sell any kind of alcoholic beverage in the United States. Now, interestingly, after that law was put into effect, historians estimate that the amount of alcohol consumed per capita in the United States increased. This is similar to the situation we have today in most countries where narcotics are illegal, where heroin and cocaine and even marijuana are illegal. Well, that certainly doesn't mean nobody gets them, because when you make a commodity illegal that millions of people desire, you have created the conditions for a successful black market. And so a black market in alcoholic beverages grew up almost overnight in the United States. Some people had always made illegal alcoholic beverages anyhow, in some of the backwoods areas, the hills of the Appalachians. The people had never, like, remember the whiskey tax I told you about? The descendants of the whiskey boys, they had never liked paying the federal tax. And since the federal government had put a tax on alcoholic beverages during the Civil War and then never kept it off, took it off, another ratchet effect. Okay? Now the federal government puts a tax on every bottle of whiskey, and these illegal whiskey makers were just avoiding the federal tax, which was quite high. And therefore they were able to make their product cheaply, and they always had an immediate market for it with their friends and neighbors, and sometimes with customers farther away. So immediately, these people making what we call moonshine whiskey, you know, made in the dark of night with only the moon to provide light for what you're doing. These moonshine producers were becoming big businessmen all over the hills of Appalachia. They were making whiskey as fast as they could. And because you can get a lot more alcohol from whiskey than you can from beer, hardly anybody tried to make beer after the Prohibition law. That was too risky to haul around big barrels of beer when you could get the same kick from a much smaller amount of hard liquor. So people who had just drunk beer and wine before now started turning into drunks because they were drinking whiskey and other hard liquors, rum, vodka, whatever they could find, gin. Americans made something they called bathtub gin. This was something they used their own bathrooms at home to provide a factory. And so half the people in America were making illegal alcoholic beverages during Prohibition. Just the way now, all over America, people are growing marijuana and the smugglers are bringing in cocaine and heroin by the thousands of tons all the time. The government of the United States thinks it's going to find some terrorists crossing the border, but it can't find 100,000 tons of cocaine. All a terrorist has to do, obviously, is get on the cocaine ship, and he'll sail right in. But, of course, this situation with black markets is also one in which all the legal authorities are ripe for corruption. You just pay the sheriff to look the other way. You pay off the police if you're operating in a city. And so organized crime had a wonderful time during Prohibition. And the great American gangsters, people like Al Capone, whose name is still famous today, Al Capone is just a thug. He's just a guy like many black market operators who's willing to take risk and who's fairly brutal. So that now when you have a dispute, you can't go to the courts to settle your dispute over illegal liquor. You've got to kill the people you have a dispute with. So organized crime became very active under Prohibition, dealing in hard liquor. And people were getting rich. Police were getting rich. Now we even have musicals. Have you seen Chicago? All about the that period of American history. Well, that's sometimes called the Great Experiment. And even though it was really good for crooked politicians and for bootleggers and moonshiners and people like that, it was not good for society in general because the level of violence increased greatly. If you look at the murder rate in America, it went way up during the time of Prohibition because people were settling their disputes by killing each other, just as today drug dealers may settle their disputes by killing each other because they don't have access to the government courts for that purpose. So finally, Prohibition was removed. The Constitution was amended by a new amendment, which repealed the old one. And the regulation of alcohol was turned back to the states. Some of the states continued to have prohibition for a long time. Eventually, they all stopped that, but it's only, I think, within the last 20 years or so, the last state gave up its prohibition. I believe the last one was either Kansas or South Carolina, one of those. But, when all the states around you have liquor for sale and it's illegal in your state, then, of course, everybody's going out of the state and bringing it back in truckloads. And this was a paradise for small-scale smugglers in this situation. It's like like Liechtenstein having prohibition. That's not very workable. Okay, the progressives changed a great many things in America, but for our purposes in looking at the policies the government enacted from that time forward, the important thing is to appreciate the ideological change that took place during that time. A move toward activism of the federal government in foreign affairs, activism of the federal government in domestic affairs, a strong belief among many people, and even more after the Great Depression of the 1930s, the general public was won over then. People came to believe, in most cases, that we needed a strong federal government. We needed it to do many, many different tasks. The classical liberals were old-fashioned. They were wrong. They were living in the horse and buggy age, people said. You can't have a modern economy without a lot of regulation and a lot of government involvement. Well, that was a great mistake. And in fact, the great economist Friedrich Hayek demonstrated very compellingly that it was backwards. In fact, the more complicated an economy is, the less feasible any form of government direction becomes. And a complex economy can be operated successfully only through markets. No other system is effective. And if you go to the extreme and adopt central planning, you are guaranteeing yourself a failed economy and the impoverishment of your population. We now have a great many case studies to demonstrate that. But some economists realized this a long time ago. As long ago as 1920, Ludwig von Mises wrote very compellingly why socialism could never work as a rational way of allocating resources. And later Hayek developed Mises' arguments further and added to them. But in both cases, they were making an argument that contemporaries did not accept. They were disregarded for a long time. And the activists continued to control the debate. They continued to control intellectual life. They continued to control political life. Now, maybe 30 years ago, the intellectual currents began to shift so that people began to realize that government could get too big. It could become ruinous. Certainly central planning, people realized, was a disaster. But in the Western European economies and in the United States, the politicians continued to go forward as if the intellectual currents had not changed at all. And they still had a wide degree of public support, so they've continued even in recent decades to add new regulations, to get the government involved in areas where it was not involved before, or to keep it involved where it had become involved. And so there's been relatively little retrenchment of the scope and scale of government in the advanced countries. But they too are subject to the same forces that Mises and Hayek identified. If we're rich in the West, we're rich in spite of what our governments do, not because of what they do. It's very easy to make a mistake in this respect. How long it will take the world to learn this lesson, indeed whether it will ever learn this lesson, is an open question. But at least we've gone part of the way, because we've learned that central planning does not work, and that was an excellent start, which in China especially is responsible for millions and millions of people now having a better life than they had 20 years ago. So not every change is for the worse. I have a reputation as a pessimist. Things are always getting worse. But they're not always getting worse everywhere. And there remains some hope even for the West. So I'm going to stop here a little early today. And if some of you want to stay and ask me questions or talk to me, that I would be very happy to talk to you. If not, please feel free to use this 15 minutes as compensation for those times I held you too long.